You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. You're listening to the Hour of the Time, and I'm William Cooper, the man William Jefferson Clinton named in a White House memo, which Rush Limbaugh read on the air, as the most dangerous radio host in America. And just stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, and if you'd like to know why, you'll find out. And it will be obvious. For those of you who would like to hook up to our website, let me give you the address. It's http://www.telepath.com/believer. That's http://www.telepath. That's T-E-L-E-P-A-T-H, telepath.com. /believer, B-E-L-I-E-V-E-R. Plug yourself into our website, folks, and you'll find a world of information that you never knew existed. It might even lead you into some avenues that you never considered before. Also, if you'd like to order a copy of Oklahoma City Day 1, you may do so by calling 1-800-888-9999. You can order it with any credit card. That's 1-800-888-9999. For Oklahoma City Day 1, it's $34.95 post-paid. And you can order it by calling 1-800-888-9999 with any credit card. Or you can send $34.95 to the Harvest Trust. Make your check or money order payable to the Harvest Trust and send it to the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 2470. That's P.O. Box 2470, Pine Top, Arizona. That's Pine Top, Arizona, 85935. That's 85935. Once again, the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 2470, Pine Top, Arizona, 85935. That is the new address for the Harvest Trust, so if you're still got the old address laying around, get rid of it. Write the new address down, folks. Our office hours are 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. And please only use this phone number for conducting business with the Harvest Trust. That's 520-333-4578. 520-333-4578. That's the only number that you should use for transacting any business with Harvest Trust. And you'll reach my secretary, Connie. If you want to inquire about an order that you've placed, call Annie at 520-333-5698. That's 520-333-5698. If you've got a question about anything that you've ordered, she's there right now. So you can call her at that number, and she'll be happy to help you. Also, the number of Southwest International Trading, which is one of our sponsors, 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432. If you'd like to buy Survival Pack Number 1 or Survival Pack Number 2, I haven't talked to Gene, and I haven't been notified that we've received 100 callers on Survival Pack Number 2 yet, so it seems to be still open. Survival Pack Number 1 is 1 1/10 ounce Gold Eagle, 1 British Gold Sovereign, 1 1/2 roll Silver Eagle dollars and one roll of what are known as junk dimes, 90% silver dimes. All for the ridiculously low price of $250. That's 1-800-295-2432. Our survival pack number two, that's 4 1/10 ounce gold eagles and one roll of junk quarters. It's 90% silver quarters. All for the ridiculously low price of $220 postpaid. That's 4 1/10 ounce gold eagle coins and one roll of what are known as junk quarters. All for the ridiculously low price of only $220 postpaid. Now, this offer is limited to the first 100 callers. I don't know how many people have called, folks. All I know is Gene has not told me that he's reached 100 callers yet. So you still have a chance to get in on this deal. The number is 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432. Remember, every dollar you spend with Southwest International Trading brings you security in the form of precious metals to protect the assets that you have against an economic collapse or economic emergency. And you will help at the same time to fund the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, the Hour of the Time, and all of our other wonderful programming. So take advantage of these wonderful offers right now and help protect your assets against an economic emergency. Let me see. What's next? Yeah. If you would like, folks, to lower your long-distance phone rate, both out-of-state and in-state, doesn't make any difference. We can help you do that. We can give you a long-distance plan in your state and out of your state that's only 10 cents a minute. And that's 10 cents a minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, as long as you're a customer. So if you are interested in that, we can get you switched over right away. Call Connie between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Monday, and she'll answer all your questions and get you signed up and get you switched. There's no hitch. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to sell anything. You don't have to pay anything up front. You don't have to pay anything later except for a $1 per month service charge. And that's the lowest service charge in the telephone industry, ladies and gentlemen. And by golly, 10 cents a minute is nothing to laugh at. It can cost you an awful lot to make long-distance phone calls. So we help you by lowering your phone bill, which gives you more money in your pocket, and at the same time, you're helping to fund the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, the Hour of the Time, and all of our other wonderful programming that we're bringing to you now. And we've expanded our programming Monday through Friday nights to 6 hours now. And that's great. And we're going to continue to expand as we continue to generate the revenue to be able to do that. Revenue. What am I talking about? To generate the funds to be able to do that. And we will bring you more and more of the most wonderful programs that you've ever heard before. Those of you who have been listening to the music that we play, you know that this is a very special network. You don't hear this music anywhere else. And you can listen to us for a long, 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 long time before you ever hear the same tune played twice. And if you do, it's by another artist. So, folks, don't forget, right after this broadcast is over, we've got 5 more hours of programming on the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. And if you're an affiliate station and you're not carrying this programming, you're missing a great bet. So listen in. And if you like it, carry it on your affiliate station. And if you're a listener on satellite or however you're listening to this broadcast, and we hope you enjoy it. We'd like to hear your feedback. Send us a letter and let us know. Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 2470, Pine Top, Arizona, 85935. Also, our annual trip to Area 51 will be made on over the Labor Day weekend. And I can only take 21 people. That's it, period, no more. That's all I'm taking. I can't take you if you offer me $1 million if I've already got 21 people, so you need to get your money in now. Don't wait. Don't think that you might not make it. Just send your money in immediately, and when we've got 21 people signed up and paid for, if we get your check or money order after that, we'll send it right back to you, and I will make an announcement on the radio that the Area 51 trip is full. Now, somebody last year tried going out there and just sort of joining the group. That won't work, folks. That won't work at all. So don't think about that either. Okay, so if you want to get in on it, it's $250 for members, $300 for non-members. Get your check or money order in immediately. If you've got small children, call us, and we'll find out what we can do about a special price or letting them come for nothing. But they've got to be able to sleep in the same bed with you because, you know, if they take up a bed, they're going to pay the price for that bed and for those meals and things. So, you know, we'll figure it out. We'll work with you. But give me a call at 520-333-4578 between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Fridays. Okay, folks? Now, today I'm going to do what I said I was going to do yesterday, and I want you to pay attention, take notes, because this is incredible. I'm going to give you a book review. I'm just going to read a little portion of a book. I'm going to tell you what the book is. If you like it, go buy it. If you don't, don't. I don't get any money from it. I'm not selling the book. This is just something that, you know, how I am, folks. I think if I think you should be reading something, I'll let you know. Don't go away. I'll be right back with the book review. Ladies and gentlemen, today I'm going to read you an essay from a book, and I think you're going to enjoy this. I'm going to open your mind a little bit and let some sunshine in, give you some alternatives to consider. The book is called Electrogravitic Systems, Reports on a New Propulsion Methodology by Thomas Vallone. That's V as in Victor, A-L-O-N-E. And he's got a few initials after his name, M-A-P-E. That's Electrogravitic Systems, Reports on a New Propulsion Methodology by Thomas Vallone, M-A-P-E. And this essay is from the book. And I'm reading this to you as a book review so that if you think this is interesting, you go down and buy the book and read it. Called The U.S. Anti-Gravity Squadron by Paul A. LaViolette, Ph.D. And it's extremely interesting, so pay close attention, ladies and gentlemen. If I don't finish it today, I will on Monday. For many years, rumors circulated that the United States was secretly developing a highly advanced radar-evading aircraft. Rumor turned to reality in November of 1988. When the Air Force unveiled the B-2 Advanced Technology Bomber. Although military spokesmen provided the news media with some information about the craft's outward design and low radar and infrared profile, there was much they were silent about. However, several years later, some key secrets about the B-2 were leaked to the press. On March 2, 1992, Tonto was sitting around the fire while the Long Ranger went in, oh, Wrong book. Sorry, folks. On March 9th, 1992, Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine made a surprising disclosure that the B-2 electrostatically charges its exhaust stream and the leading edges of its wing-like body. Those familiar with the electrogravitics research of American physicist T. Townsend Brown will quickly realize that this is tantamount to stating that the B-2 is able to function as an anti-gravity aircraft. Did I get your attention with that little deviation there? Well, that's exactly what I meant to do. You never know what you're going to hear, folks, so pay attention. Aviation Week obtained their information about the B-2 from a small group of renegade West Coast scientists and engineers who were formerly associated with black research projects. In making these disclosures, these scientists broke a code of silence that rivals the mafia's. They took the risk because they felt that it was important for economic reasons that efforts be made to declassify certain black technologies for commercial use. Two of these individuals said that their civil rights had been blatantly abused in the name of security, either to keep them quiet or to prevent them from leaving the tightly controlled black research and development community. Now, several months after Aviation Week published the article, black world security personnel went into high gear. That sector of the black research and development community received very strong warnings, and as a result, the group of scientists subsequently broke off contact with the magazine. Now, clearly, the overseers of black research and development programs were substantially concerned about the information leaks that had come out in that article. To completely understand the significance of what was said about the B-2, one must first become familiar with Brown's work. Beginning in the mid-1920s, Townsend Brown discovered that it is possible to create an artificial gravity field by charging an electrical capacitor to a high voltage. He specially built a capacitor which utilized a heavy, high-charge accumulating, high K-factor dielectric material between its plates and found that when charges with between 70,000 to 300,000 volts, it would move in the direction of its positive pole. When oriented with its positive side up, it would proceed to lose about 1% of its weight. He attributed this motion to an electrostatically induced gravity field acting between the capacitor's oppositely charged plates. And by 1958, he had succeeded in developing a 15-inch diameter model saucer that could lift over 110% of its weight. Brown's experiments had launched a new field of investigation, which came to be known as electrogravitics, the technology of controlling gravity through the use of high-voltage electric charge. As early as 1952, an Air Force Major General witnessed a demonstration in which Brown flew a pair of 18-inch disc airfoils suspended from opposite ends of a rotatable arm. When electrified with 50,000 volts, they circuited at a speed of 12 miles per hour. And about a year later, he flew a set of 3-foot diameter saucers for some Air Force officials and representatives from a number of major aircraft companies. When energized with 150,000 volts, the discs sped around the 50-foot diameter course so fast that the subject was immediately classified. The Interavia magazine later reported that the discs would obtain speeds of several hundred miles per hour when charged with several hundred thousand volts. Brown's discs were charged with a high positive voltage on a wire running along their leading edge and a high negative voltage on a wire running around their trailing edge. As the wires ionized the air around them, a dense cloud of positive ions would form ahead of the craft, and corresponding clouds of negative ions would form behind the craft. Brown's research indicated that, like the charged plates of his capacitors, these ion clouds induced a gravitational force directed in the minus to plus direction. Now, as the disk moved forward in the response to its self-generated gravity field, it would carry with it its positive and negative ion clouds and their associated electrogravity gradient. Consequently, the disks would ride their advancing gravity wave much like surfers ride an ocean wave. Dr. Mason Rose, one of Townsend's colleagues, described the disk's principle of operation as follows. The saucers made by Brown have no propellers, no jets, no moving parts at all. They create a modification of the gravitational field around themselves, which is analogous to putting them on the incline of a hill. They act like a surfboard on a wave. The electrogravitational saucer creates its own hill, which is a local distortion of the gravitational field. Then it takes this hill with it in any chosen direction and at any rate. The occupants of one of Brown's saucers would feel no stress at all, no matter how sharp the turn or how great the acceleration. This is because the ship and its occupants and the load are all responding equally to the wave-like distortion of the local gravitation field. Now, although skeptics at first thought that the disks were propelled by more mundane effects, such as the pressure of negative ions striking the positive electrode, Brown later carried out vacuum chamber tests, which proved that a force was present even in the absence of such ion thrust. He did not offer a theory to explain this non-conventional electrogravitic phenomenon, except to say that it was predicted neither by general relativity nor by modern theories of electromagnetism. However, recent advances in theoretical physics provide a rather straightforward explanation of the principle. According to the Novell physics of subquantum kinetics, gravity potential can adopt two polarities instead of one. Not only can a gravity field exist in the form of a matter attracting gravity potential well, as standard physics teaches, but it can also exist in the form of a matter repelling gravity potential hill. Moreover, it predicts that these gravity polarities should be directly matched with electrical polarity. Positively charged particles, such as protons generating gravity wells, and negatively charged particles, such as electrons generating gravity hills. Thus, contrary to conventional theory, the electron produces a matter-repelling gravity field. Electrical neutral matter remains gravitationally attractive because of the proton's G-well marginally dominates the electron's G-hill. So consequently, subquantum kinetics predicts that the negative ion cloud behind Brown's disk should form a matter-repelling gravity hill, while the positive ion cloud ahead of the disk should form a matter-attracting gravity well. So as increasing voltage is applied to the disk, the gravity potential hill and well become increasingly prominent and the gravity potential gradient between them increasingly steep. In Rose's terminology, the craft would find itself on the incline of a gravitational hill. Since gravity force is known to increase in accordance with the steepness of such a gravity potential slope, increased voltage would induce an increasingly strong gravity force on the disk, and it would act in the direction of the positive ion cloud. The disk would behave as if it were being tugged by a very strong gravitational field emanating from an invisible planet-sized mass positioned beyond its positive pole. Now, early in 1952, ladies and gentlemen, Brown had put together a proposal codenamed Project Winterhaven, which suggested that the military developed an anti-gravity combat saucer with Mach 3 capability. The 1956 intelligence study entitled Electrogravitic Systems, An Explanation of Electrostatic Motion, Dynamic Counterbury, and Barycentric Control, prepared by the private aviation intelligence firm Aviation Studies International Limited, indicates that as early as November 1954, the Air Force had begun plans to fund research that would accomplish Project Winter Haven's objectives. This study, originally classified confidential, mentions the name of more than 10 major aircraft companies which were actively involved in the electrogravitics research in an attempt to duplicate or extend Brown's seminal work. Additional information is to be found in another aviation intelligence report entitled The Gravitics Situation. Now, since that time, much of the work in anti-gravity has proceeded in Air Force black projects on a relatively large, and I mean large, scale. One indication, folks, that Brown's electrogravitics ideas were being researched by the aerospace industry surfaced in January 1968 at an aerospace sciences meeting held in New York. Northrop officials reported that they were beginning wind tunnel studies to research the aerodynamic effects of applying high voltage charges to the leading edges of aircraft bodies. Now, they said that they expected that the resulting electrical potential would ionize air molecules upwind of the aircraft, and that the resulting repulsive electrical forces would condition the airstream so as to lower drag, reduce heating, and soften the supersonic boom. Although the author of that article speculated that Northrop might be negatively charging the aircraft's leading edge, the sonic barrier effects can also be accomplished with a positive charge, as Brown originally suggested. Although this sonic cushion effect is purely electrostatic, Northrop apparently got the idea for investigating this effect directly from Brown, for his electrokinetic flying disc patent explains that the positively charged leading edge electrode would produce just this effect. Brown states, "By using such a nose form, which at present appears to be best suited for flying speeds approaching or exceeding the speed of sound, I am able to produce an ionization of the atmosphere in the immediate region of this foremost position of the mobile vehicle. I believe that this ionization facilitates piercing sonic barrier and minimizes the abruptness with which the transition takes place in passing from subsonic velocities to supersonic velocities." Now, also in his 1952 paper on Brown's saucers, Dr. Rose stated, "The Townsend-Brown experiments indicate that the positive field, which is traveling in front of the saucer, acts as a buffer wing, which starts moving the air out of the way. This field acts as a entering wedge, which softens the sonic barrier." Interestingly, in 1981, the Pentagon contracted the Northrop Corporation to work on the highly classified B-2 advanced technology bomber. Northrop's past experience in airframe electrostatics must have been a key factor contributing to its winning of this contract, for Aviation Week reported that the B-2 uses electrostatic field-generating techniques in its wing leading edges to help it minimize aerodynamic turbulence and thereby reduce its radar cross-section. The very same article mentions that the B-2 also charges its jet engine exhaust stream, which has the effect of rapidly cooling its exhaust and thereby remarkably reducing its thermal signature. Now, although these disclosures were framed in the context of enhancing the B-2's radar invisibility, in fact, they are part of the B-2's anti-gravitic drive capability. With a positively charged wing leading edge and a negatively charged exhaust system, the B-2 would function essentially as an electrogravitic aircraft. Just as in Townsend Brown's flying discs, the positive and negative ion clouds would produce a locally altered gravity field that would cause the B-2 to feel a forward-directed gravitic force. Now, this design is also very similar to the saucer craft that Brown described in his electrokinetic generator patent. The craft Brown proposed was to be powered by a flame jet generator, a high-voltage power supply that had the advantage of being both efficient and relatively lightweight. His generator design utilizes a jet engine with an electrified needle mounter in the exhaust nozzle to produce negative ions in the jet's exhaust system. The negatively ionized exhaust is then discharged through a number of nozzles at the rear of the craft. As the minus charges leave the craft in this manner, an increasingly greater potential difference develops between the jet engine body and the negatively charged exhaust cloud behind the craft. So by electrically insulating the engines and conveying their positive charges forward to a wire running along the vehicle's leading edge, the required positively charged ion cloud is built up at the front of the vehicle. A metallic surface of wire grid positioned near the exhaust stream exit collects some of the high voltage electrons, and this recycled power is used to run the exhaust ionizers. Brown estimated that such a generator could produce potentials as high as 15 million volts across his craft. Rumors circulating among people close to the project allege that the B-2 does utilize anti-gravity technology. So our conjecture that the B-2 incorporates an electrogravitic drive appears to be substantially correct. If this is true, the B-2 is the first mass-produced anti-gravity vehicle to be displayed to the public. And the key words are, to be displayed to the public. It is the final realization of the kind of craft that Brown had proposed in Project Winterhaven and that the 1956 Aviation Studies Report had disclosed was beginning to be developed by the military in late 1954. The secrecy that has so tightly surrounded the B-2 most likely does not as much concern its radar evading technology as it does its anti-gravity propulsion technology, although both are probably closely intertwined. The use of such non-conventional propulsion technology would explain the B-2's high price tag, which has averaged well over $1 billion, that's billion with a B, $1 billion per aircraft.
Although the Black World scientists mentioned nothing about electrogravitics in their Aviation Week disclosure about the B-2, they did admit to the existence of very dramatic classified technologies applicable to aircraft control and propulsion. They were especially hesitant to discuss these projects, noting that they are very black, which means secret, ladies and gentlemen. One of them commented, "Besides, it would take about 20 hours to explain the principles, and very few people would understand them anywhere." Apparently, what he meant is that this aircraft, control and propulsion technology, is based upon physics principles that go way beyond what is currently known and understood by most academic physicists and certainly by the public. Indeed, by all normal standards, electrogravitics is a very exotic propulsion science. The B-2's body design raises suspicions that the aircraft is indeed an electrogravitic vehicle. A primary design criterion for an electrogravitic craft is that it have a large horizontal disposed surface area so as to permit the development of a sufficiently strong anti-gravity lift force. Now, as Townsend Brown's experiments demonstrated, such an aircraft need not necessarily be disc-shaped. Triangular and square-shaped forms also exhibit anti-gravity lift when electrified, although disc shapes give the best performance. The triangular platforms used in the B-2 and other advanced stealth aircraft may have been deemed better for reasons of their much lower radar cross-section. Interestingly, folks, one of the central features of the B-2's classified technology is the makeup of its hull's outer surface. Authorities tell us that the hull is composed of highly classified radar-absorbing material. Ceramic dielectrics are a likely choice for the B-2, since unlike many lossy dielectrics, which function as radar wave absorbers, they are lossless and hence transparent to radar waves. More importantly, ceramic dielectrics also have the ability to store large amounts of high voltage charge. Could the B-2's outer ram layer be fabricated from an advanced high-K, high-density, dielectric ceramic, a material capable of exerting an enormous electrogravitic lift force when charged? Knowing that high-voltage charge is applied to the B-2's surface, the notion that its body surface is designed to function as a giant high-voltage capacitor does not seem so far-fetched. Given that the outer ram skin is a key component of the B-2's highly secret electrogravitic propulsion system, it is not surprising that special care would be taken to keep its composition secret. Evidence that the B-2 might indeed use a high-density ceramic ram comes from information leaked by the above-mentioned Black World scientists who disclosed about the development of low-radar observability dielectric ceramics made from powdered depleted uranium. The material is said to have approximately 92% the bulk density of uranium, which would give it a specific gravity of about 17.5, as opposed to about 6 for barium titanate dielectrics. Thus, the new material has about 3 times the density of the high-K ceramics that were being tested in the 1950s, and hence would develop at least 3 times the electrogravitic pull. The B-2's positively charged leading edge, another key component of its propulsion technology, was also a matter of special concern to Northrop's designers. According to Aviation Week, the bomber's leading edges posed a particularly challenging production problem on the first aircraft. The leading edge ionizer is most probably a conductive strip that runs along the B-2's sharp prow and is electrically charged to upwards of many millions of volts. As the B-2 moves forward, its electrified leading edge deflects the approaching airstream to either side so that a large fraction of the generated positive ions are carried away from its body surface and are prevented from immediately contacting and neutralizing the negative ions in the B-2's exhaust charges ahead of and behind itself, which subject it to a large gravitational potential gradient. Now, this artificially produced gravitational gradient, ladies and gentlemen, would steepen as the B2 attains higher speeds and deflects its positive ions outward with increasing force. Hence, the B2's electrogravitic drive would operate more efficiently when the craft was moving at higher speeds. Best results would be obtained when the B2 was traveling at supersonic speeds. Positive ions from its leading edge would become entrained in the upwind sonic shock front and flow away from the craft through that sonic boundary layer to later converge on the negatively charged exhaust stream. Although military sources claim that the B-2 is a subsonic vehicle, in all likelihood, it is capable of supersonic flight. Probably this capability was not disclosed in order to avoid raising curiosity about how the craft generates the required thrust. Both in subsonic and supersonic flight, the deflected positive ions would form an ellipsoidal sheath as they circuited around the B2. The B2's forward positive ion sheath would act very much like an extended positively charged electrode surface. Thus, the electrogravitic force propelling the B2 would arise not just from the leading edge electrode, but also from the entire positively charged forward ion sheath. The positive and negative ion space charge distributions would very much resemble the charge configuration that Brown employed in some of his later electrogravitic experiments. Brown noted that he obtained a greater electrogravitic thrust when the positive electrode was curved and made much larger than his negative electrode. He also stated that the apparatus produced greater thrust if the dielectric constant of the intervening dielectric rod increased along its length so as to produce a non-uniform electric field relative to the positively charged canopy. This describes precisely the characteristic of the B2's trailing exhaust system. At increasing distances from the craft, the negative ions progressively slow down and become more concentrated, thereby creating a non-linear electrogravitic field along the length of the exhaust stream. Thus, the B2's ion sheath is optimally configured as an electrogravitic drive. Each of the B2's leading edges is segmented into 8 sections, separated from one another by 10 centimeter wide struts. Quite possibly, the struts electrically isolate the sections from one another so that they may be individually electrified. In this way, through proper control of the applied voltage, it would be possible to gravitically steer the craft. Brown had suggested a similar idea as a way of steering his saucer craft way back in the 50s. The leading edge section, positioned in front of the air scoops, most likely are sparingly electrified so as to prevent positive ions from entering the engine ducts and neutralizing the negative ions being produced there. These two non-electrified leading edge sections would be ideal places to mount forward-looking radar antenna, since the ion plasma sheath produced by the other leading edge sections would form a barrier that would interfere with radar signal transmission. In fact, the B-2's two Hughes aircraft radar units are mounted precisely on these leading edge locations right in front of the air intakes, lending so much credibility to the supposition put forth in this paper. The 1956 Electrogravitic Systems report suggested that there may be a division of responsibility in the program to develop a Mach 3 electrogravitic aircraft, that the condenser assembly, which is the core of the main structure, be developed by an airframe manufacturer, and that the flame jet generator, which provides the electrostatic energy for the craft, be developed by companies specializing in jet engine technology. Consistent with that suggestion, we find that Northrop, a company experienced in aircraft electrostatics, was contracted to develop the B-2's airframe, and that General Electric, a company experienced in the development of jet engines and superconducting electrical generators, was contracted to develop the B-2's engines. In fact, the report mentions General Electric as one of the companies involved in early electrogravitics work. Also, it is known that in 1959, Townsend Brown conducted electrogravitics vacuum chamber experiments at the General Electric Aerospace facilities. Now, folks, authorities claim that the Stealth is powered by four General Electric F-118 GE-100 jet engines similar to those used in the F-16 fighter. However, the absence of forceful exhaust thrust from the B-2, especially at takeoff, leads us to suspect that the B-2 does not operate on a conventional jet thrust principle. Rather, its engines more likely are designed to function as flame jet high voltage generators. The propulsive force lofting the craft then would come not so much from the jet exhaust thrust as it would from the electrogravitic force field electrically powered by the jet's generators. Such flame jet generators also would account for the presence of ions, which Aviation Week says are present in the B-2's exhaust system. As in Brown's saucer, the engine body would acquire a high positive charge as it exhausted negative ions. Presumably, the engine is electrically insulated from the aircraft's hull, and its positive charges are conducted forward to power the leading edge ionizers. The B-2's GE engines are reported to each be capable of putting out 19,000 pounds of thrust. Consequently, all four engines together should provide the B-2 with a total output of about 140,000 horsepower, which translates into electrical power output of about 25 megawatts, assuming 30% conversion efficiency. Now, this horsepower estimate is based upon the assumption that the jets would be able to propel the craft to a velocity of about 600 miles per hour, which is Mach 0.8. By comparison, the November 1954 Aviation Report concluded that a 35-foot diameter electrogravitic combat disc would need to have access to about 50 megawatts of power in order to attain Mach 3 flight speeds. So it appears that the magnitude of the B-2's power output is in the right ballpark. When the B-2 was unveiled in 1988, one Air Force official commented that the B-2 uses a system of baffles to mix cool intake air with its hot exhaust gases so as to cool the gases and thereby make them less visible to infrared-guided missiles. Although infrared invisibility might be a side benefit, most likely the real purpose for diluting the exhaust is to greatly increase the flow volume and hence the ability of the exhaust stream to eject negative charges from the craft. Much of the air entering the B-2's intake scoops probably bypasses the flame jet intake and is mixed with the jet's hot ionized exhaust flame jet intake and is Let me read that sentence again, folks, just to make sure that it's clear, because I think I got a little mixed up. Much of the air entering the B-2's intake scoops probably bypasses the flame jet intake and is mixed with the jet's hot ionized exhaust. Additional ions would be injected into the combined airstream by means of additional downstream electrodes. This augmented volume of ionized gases would then discharge through the low rectangular exhaust nozzles positioned near the rear of the B-2's wing. As the exhaust stream leaves the nozzles, they contact the titanium-coated overwing exhaust ducts. These open duct sections may function as rear electrical grids that collect million-volt electrons from the exhaust streams and recycle them to power the exhaust and wing air ionizers. This would be done in the same fashion as Brown had suggested in his patent. As exhaust leaves the craft, it passes over trailing edge exhaust deflectors, flaps which can be swiveled so as to direct the exhaust stream either up or down for flight control. This accomplishes more than just vectoring if the exhaust thrusts. It also changes the direction of the electrogravitic force on the craft become... Boy, this is hard to read, folks. I'm going to back up a little bit here. This accomplishes more than just the vectoring if the exhaust thrusts. It also changes the direction of the electrogravitic force vector. When the exhaust is deflected downward, negative charges are directed below the craft. As a result, the electrogravitic force on the craft becomes vectored upward as well as forward. When the exhaust stream is deflected upward, its negative ions are directed above the craft, resulting in an electrogravitic force that is directed downward as well as forward. Thus, by controlling these flaps, the B-2 is able to control its field so as to induce either a gain or loss of altitude. Once the B-2 got going fast enough, it would receive sufficient airflow through its scoops that it could maintain a relatively high flow rate of ionized exhaust, even with its engine combustion thrust substantially reduced. Since hot exhaust is not essential to its operation, the high voltage generator could just as well run on cool intake air with the flame jets entirely shut off. As Brown points out in his electrokinetic generator patent, it is to be understood that any other fluid stream source might be substituted for the combustion chamber and fuel supply. In such a coasting mode, where jet combustion is entirely shut off, the B-2 would be able to fly for an indefinitely long period of time with essentially zero fuel consumption, powering itself primarily with energy tapped from its self-generated gravitational gradient. For example, during coasting, the kinetic energy of the scooped air stream would arise entirely from the craft's own forward motion, this motion in turn being due to the pull of the electrogravitic propulsion field. The kinetic energy of this ionized airstream is responsible for linearly accelerating negative ions down the B-2's exhaust ducts and hence for creating the multi-megavolt potential difference relative to the positively charged engine body. The craft's high-voltage electron collector grids, the overwing exhaust ducts, recover a portion of this power to run the craft's ionizers. Provided that this power drain is not excessive and that the plane's propulsive gravity field can be adequately maintained, the craft would be able to achieve a state of perpetual propulsion. Such perpetual motion behavior is possible in devices having the capability to manipulate their own gravity field. It should be added here that when the B-2 flies at a sufficiently high velocity, such that the flow rate of its scooped air exceeds many times the exhaust flow rate from its jet turbines, the electrical power output of its mixed exhaust will be comparably larger, perhaps exceeding 100 megawatts. Now, when the B-2 was first unveiled, critics had suggested that it could not risk flying at high altitudes because it might create vapor trails that would be visible to an enemy. Edward Aldridge, Jr., the Secretary of the Air Force, was asked whether that problem had been solved. He replied, "Yes, but we're not going to disclose how." Clearly, to explain how the B-2 could travel at high altitude with its engines essentially shut off and producing no vapor trail, it would have to disclose the vehicle's non-conventional mode of propulsion. Incidentally, folks, in such a coasting mode, the B-2's waste heat output also would be greatly reduced, hence lessening its chance of being detected with infrared sensors. The B-2's emergency power units, or EPUs, probably play a key role in assisting such high-altitude flight. According to Bill Scott, each EPU consists of a small, self-contained gas turbine powered by hydrazine, a liquid that rapidly decomposes into gases when activated by a catalyst. The expanding gases are made to drive a turbine, which in turn drives an electrical generator. Public disclosures state that the purpose of the EPU is to supply electric power to the craft should the B-2's four jet engines happen to flame out of its 4 electrical generators happened to simultaneously fail. More likely, they were designed to function as auxiliary generators capable of operating at high altitudes or even in space where the air would be too thin to sustain normal jet combustion. At high altitude, the decomposed hydrazine gases would take the place of scooped air as the medium for transporting ions from the craft. That is, after passing through the EPU, these gases would be electrified and expelled from the craft in the same fashion as would the jet exhaust. Townsend Brown noted that his electrogravitic propulsion system could run just as well using a compressed gas source such as carbon dioxide as the ion-carrying medium as it could using the exhaust from a jet engine. Is all this just idle speculation? Or could the B-2 really be the realization of one of mankind's greatest dreams, an aircraft that has mastered the ability to control gravity? I don't really know the answer, ladies and gentlemen, but this book is intriguing, and this is just a very small part of what's contained within it. So if you would like to get the book and read it, it's called Electrogravitic Systems, Reports on a New Propulsion Methodology by Thomas Vallone, V as in Victor, A-L-O-N-E, M-A-P-E. And so there you have our book report for the week. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you.
I was walking by the river. I held my hand out to feel the rain, just a light rain, almost a sunshine, making all things shine again. And I felt like was order, there was a balance, there was a flow, there was patience, indulgence, there was a power I could not know. And I felt it all made sense, innocent, a permanent.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
This is the Voice of Freedom.
Thank you.
listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. Stay tuned now for All Oldies Most of the Time. Classic radio like you always wished it could be.